Hello, everyone, and welcome to Book Spider. We are a Book of the Week format podcast that attempts to wrap our mandibles around the role of the arts in society, particularly, but not exclusively, literature. Today we are discussing Bruce Wagner's The Marvel Universe Origin Stories, which is not just a contemporary novel, but as of its writing and publication in late 2020, one of the most insistently and forcefully contemporary novels we've ever discussed on the podcast, for better or worse. It is, I think, impossible to discuss this book without first acknowledging its role as both a victim and a beneficiary of the culture wars, albeit both in a relatively small way. Wagner delivered it to his publisher and they rejected it, considering it offensive and unpublishable. And he ended up posting it for free online, following which it achieved at least a cult following, was republished, and got enough of a following, enough of a profile as a controversial book that I heard about it, which I probably wouldn't have if that little kerfluffle had not happened. But, you know, it's in addition to alienating a certain number of people and being apparently unpublishably offensive, it has also achieved a reputation for striving fearlessly to represent the present moment in fiction in ways that other novels might be too cowardly or self-consciously virtuous to attempt. And, you know, I was interested in this novel because of a feeling I have sometimes reading new work by particularly relatively young authors that I think is pretty well conveyed by this quote I encountered actually just a couple days ago from the novelist and essayist Ross Barkin. And I had already picked and read Marvel Universe before I read this quote, but I encountered it on Friday, and it summed up a lot of what had made me interested in the book that we're talking about today. So the quote from Ross Barkin is, "The politics of your contemporary American novelists are predictably lib in a mid-cult kind of way, and I find it all very tiring, even if I might agree with the positions taken. Some of today's novelists are like little plastic toys. Smack the button and the catchphrases crackle out. Once upon a time, the greatest writers of our age had a range of fascinating or even disturbing politics. Fascists and monarchists wrote fabulous novels and poetry, as did committed liberals, leftists, and communists. Roth was against the Vietnam War, but Updike was for it. I'd personally just add Nabokov as well. In some sense, the literary establishment of the 20th century far better represented America's multifarious polity. Now they all blandly vote Democrat, or they believe in a particular kind of liberalism, one that is performative and reeks of professional class smugness." I'd kind of been thinking that same thing intensely and determinedly enough that I was a little annoyed that Barkin said it so well. And he's high profile enough that he has to be discreet and avoid naming names. But I am, I have no profile at all. So I'll mention three examples I've encountered in the last couple of years that have given me the feeling he describes: Tomorrow and Tomorrow by Gabrielle Zabin, Memory Piece by Lisa Coe, Martyr by Kaveh Akbar. All three of these novels have some very compelling aspects and ideas, and in all three novels, there's an intrusive sense of the author's constant labor toward moral rightness that, for me, ruined the sense of fictional immersion, even if I agree with the points that they are conscientiously working to make. Unfortunately, it does bring me no joy to report that all three of those are probably better novels than Marvel Universe Origin Stories, which we're talking about here today. So I'm here today with the two co-hosts of the Book Spider podcast, Patrick Barney and Chris Malmberg. I am Hans Berger, the third host, and we're going to talk about whether this novel, Bruce Wagner's Marvel Universe Origin Stories, is ethically objectionable fiction, and if so, whether it has the aesthetic daring to overcome its ethical lapses. Quick synopsis before we get into that, just for anybody who hasn't read it recently or wants a refresher or just wants to see if we understood the fucking thing. Book one, The New Mutants, follows three viewpoint characters. The first, Ali Nell, is an actress who is diagnosed with ALS and briefly attempts to establish a reputation as a disease activist slash influencer. But as it turns out, She does not have ALS. She is spontaneously morphing into a bird, specifically a hoopoe, or at least a large monstrous hoopoe-like bird creature. The second viewpoint character is Joan Gamma, self-described as the Fat Joan, a billionaire heiress whose family was violently murdered while she was a teenager. When we meet Joan, she is in the process of feeding herself into a state of maximal obesity in a psychological attempt to mimic and thereby control the sense of confinement she felt while hiding under the bed while her family was murdered. However, after meeting and marrying Ollie, she begins losing weight in a rapid and indeed medically impossible manner in emulation of the climax of the film The Incredible Shrinking Man. The third character is Joan's grandfather, Bud Wiggins, a long washed up writer addicted to drugs and gambling who's trying various not too impressive schemes to get himself continued access to amphetamines and scratch tickets, although these schemes do sometimes take the form of regaining literary prominence or reconnecting with his granddaughter. Various events occur to those three people, which mostly end up being, from a plot standpoint, digressive or irrelevant, since Allie finishes her transformation into a hoopoe and kills Bud with her beak, while Joan transports herself and Allie to a volcano with the intention of committing joint suicide before shrinking to submolecular size and uniting with Allie, who flies off into the sky. Book two follows a brief side character from book one, Portia Coldstream, who makes a career of posing as Elon Musk's love child to run scams on rich older men, along with her daughter Trixana, who has delusions about being actually the daughter of the comic book character Wolverine. Now, Trixana's possible biological father, a former pimp turned Buddhist monk who is dying of cancer while wrongfully imprisoned as a serial killer, is another character that we touch on the viewpoint of. And there's also a man visiting Hollywood who serves as a mark for Portia's con schemes. But unfortunately, Portia's scheme is disrupted at its climactic moment. The mark, whose name I really should have written down but I neglected to, beats Arnold. Arnold beats Portia to death, flies back to Ohio, kills himself and his family. And Trixana, who has achieved some level of stability and coherence under medication and treatment, receives a stipend, which, in a Dickensian twist that makes her a minor celebrity, turns out to be from a foundation established by Arnold, which is to say, her mother's killer. Meanwhile, the Buddhist monk has abruptly died several chapters back in a way which doesn't seem to bear on the plot. Book three centers around Gary Gabe Gigi Vickers, a TV producer who was a marginal character in the first two books. Gigi is in the midst of being Me Too'd by two women whose accusations are transparently cynical and false, but he is haunted by a guilty memory. In the 1980s, he raped his assistant, Summer, following which she killed herself. We also spend some time in the viewpoint of Summer's daughters, Adele, a struggling stand-up comic whose career abruptly takes off, and Celeste, who has parallel affairs with both Gigi and the character Jax from book two, who was Portia's boyfriend. Celeste, with prompting from Jax, infiltrates and exposes a ring of scam artists who are running fraudulent rape cases, thereby exonerating Gigi. Celeste is pregnant, but abruptly has a miscarriage, goes back to nursing school, and visits Gigi near the end of his life as he dies from Parkinson's. Did I leave out any significant plot points, details, events, characters that you guys want to establish before we talk about the book? So, I don't always lead with this question, but this is a fairly provocative novel that takes a lot of risks. And I'm just curious to lead off with, what did everyone think about
it? It had some redeeming qualities, was my thought.
that's a glowing review. Some redeeming qualities.
Yeah, what was it?
What needed to be redeemed?
So this kind of jumps ahead to your third question, Hans, where you're asking about dislikable characters and whether the novel succeeds in making me feel empathy for dislikable characters. So a lot of the characters are dislikable. Strangely, like the Allie, Bud, Joan part, I felt like those three characters were of all the other characters the most, like they did the least shitty stuff things, right? Like the other parts, the characters were all pretty bad. Maybe not Adele or Celeste. Celeste is two time and a couple people, but compared to like Gigi being a rapist and Jax being like part of, a con to steal money from people, like Celeste is kind of the least.
I mean, one of the guys she's two-timing is married, so, not the biggest sin in the world.
Right, yeah, it's not like the worst. Like
Right.
what she's
He's
doing.
perhaps not owed a great deal of fidelity anyway.
Right. So, like the Allie, so or Allie, Joan, and Gigi and Bud are the three characters who are kind of the least bad, the least worst of typo negative, the least bad. And that was actually the part that I was least interested in. And so part two with Jax and Arnold from Ohio and Portia, I found pretty. I mean, I was intrigued. I was like, what's gonna happen? And when Arnold ends up beating Portia to death, I was like, holy shit! Like I didn't know that was gonna happen. And then Arnold goes back and he commits murder suicide with his family. And like I was like, wow! Like I'm kind of my feelers are kind of hurting right now. Like it, I so and I think that continued on into the next part where, Gigi's a freaking rapist who caused someone to kill herself, and yet by the end of that part I'm like, wow, Gigi, I feel a little bad for Gigi. I feel a little bad for Jax. I thought that the novel did succeed in making me feel empathy for some of these characters. So I thought that was a positive quality of the novel. And the quality of the novel that I, to answer your question, Chris, that I thought needed to be redeemed was the fact that like it's so milquetoast. I know you guys are like saying it's controversial because it contains a lot of real life. A lot of the characters represent real life people, a bunch of actors and actresses are mentioned. Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, Kim Kardashian is a character, and what I found kind of something I didn't quite like was that these characters were used, but I didn't like are Kim Kardashian has to be one of the most morally bankrupt, people in show business or the like there are awful people like Donald Trump or other very terrible people in the world. So by morally bankrupt, I just mean that they are like totally shallow and are, they're just trying to make money and whatnot. So like the fact that the book did not kind of directly criticize these people made me feel like, it was trying to put on the face of being edgy without actually doing anything edgy. Like, really being edgy would be talking about how Kim Kardashian is a piece of shit, how Jeff Bezos is a piece of shit. Like, that's real. Like, I don't know. So I felt that it was if there was a critique of these people, it was pretty milquetoast.
I would say, because I was thinking something similar. If the foreword to my copy, talks about the publisher's desire to have Wagner kind of edit out, you know, the things that make this an edgy novel. And there not being much left if that was done. I actually disagree with that. I think that, like, there's a lot of spectacle in how this is, like, this is edgy in a kind of spectacular way, in a kind of surface way, in a way that is mostly, like, in how electrically Wagner describes obesity and, like, kind of bizarre subcultures that that sort of, like, develop around almost like worshiping extremely fat people, and fat people racing to, like, get as fat as possible, and how that sort of that spectacle intersects with the spectacle of celebrity culture, and you know, the way in which Portia, you know, sort of like develops the Reeve persona, Elon Musk's, you know, love child, that, you know, is sort of a talking point, something that she drops into conversations with, you know, her Marx, and how, like, that you know, is important to her con. And then Bud, who is my favorite character.
He was a good character, I agree.
Yeah, he's awesome. The grandfather to Joan, the fat Joan, in part one, who is a gambling and drug addict, and his own sort of, like, strange fame, being, like, a one-time novelist, back, like, 40 years before, and otherwise being pretty much like a tick on society. And there's something in it that is, like, I feel like if you softened the edges of this novel, if you just spoke, like, if some of the words were a little bit different, if you instead of, like, actual celebrities, you just kind of, you know, sometimes this book does it too, like with Allie. Like, Allie is she plays a non real character in Arrested Development. Like, that's a fiction that this book does. But otherwise, you know, a lot of the celebrities are real celebrities, and the movies that they're in or talking about are real movies. If you just sort of did that and you made it a little bit, like, more boring, I think that actually a lot of the novel would still be there. It just would be boring. I'm glad that that didn't happen, because I actually appreciate what this novel is. This novel is spectacularly, like, funny and gross and weird, and I really generally enjoyed it. I just don't think that it's really, like, containing a lot that is meaningfully, like, challenging. And that, I think, is a pretty major limitation. I think it's a great, fun, super irreverent experience, and that is, you know, it's mostly foam. Like, there's not a lot of substance under that.
Right.
Right.
I agree with that.
I think I basically agree with that too. I mean, I don't know that there's... You certainly get the sense that Wagner is contemptuous of the shallowness of Hollywood, but I don't know that there's, but, you know, that's not a particularly creative or daring statement to make necessarily. And I don't, for the most part, I don't know that the critique that's being made here of the shallowness of Hollywood, or, you know, whatever other kind of social ills, I don't know that it presents those in ways that significantly would have changed how I thought about them. I think that if there was anything that I thought held it back from being more successful, and this might be something where I'm confusing features and bugs here, right? And I know sometimes it's annoying to kind of go, oh, well, the book could have been this kind of book and that would be better, and it's bad because it wasn't the sort of book I imagine a different person would have written, right? I know we've talked about that being an annoying tick here, and I might be about to do that, but it has this particular habit of setting up really interesting scenarios, ideas, characters, spending a certain amount of time letting them develop, and then it almost feels like it gets impatient and just kind of cuts them off with violent spectacle, right? Or goes into some different version of itself that is not as that might be wilder in some sense, but is actually less interesting, right? Like the idea, you know, when we think that Allie has ALS, right? Like the idea of this person coming to terms with this really horrifying disease, like maybe the most horrifying disease you can have almost, coming to terms with this horrifying disease in the context of this kind of like empty, vapid, bland show of Hollywood support, plus, you know, people kind of going, well, I know you have ALS, but it looks like you sort of look like you have dreads in one picture, and that's culturally insensitive, right? Like, taking that, how does a person in that context come to terms with mortality? How does that person either find some other way of being as her life ends, or how does she actually find a subtext of something valuable under that culture? Or, you know, like, how, and alternately, like, the whole idea of somebody kind of having a terrifying chronic disease and leveraging it for attention, not unfair, you know, not maybe not an unfair thing to do, but still kind of odd and gross, right? Like, it, I think that that is such an interesting setup. And rather than really explore the nuances and particularities of that, which could have turned into pretty interesting satire, or could have turned into like, it's just something really with real intrigue and depth, like, instead she turns into a hoopoe? What? And I maybe there's something thematic there, you know, maybe there's something, I'm sure that if you wanted to, you could read a thematic idea there. I know that probably there are people who might read this who would find it amusing or enjoy the kind of short circuiting of what might have been melodramatic with this kind of magical realism, but I don't know. I was disappointed by that.
What feels weird to me, Patrick? What feels weird to me about the magical realism is that it isn't really present at any other place in the book. Like, it's not like,
right.
Like, he doesn't seem to be, like, really wanting to delve into magical realism as a technique or as, like, something, like, you know, the famous magical realist guy, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, you know, whatever you think of his books, you know, he clearly has a love for magical realism and is wants to, like, explore it to its fullest extent. And here it just seems like a way to get out of a way to resolve an issue, you know, as opposed to any, you know, using it in an interesting way.
And there's a version of that criticism that I can probably see making of all three books, actually, right? Like, in the middle section, I think the relationship between Arnold and Portia, and Arnold's kind of seeing the con from Arnold's perspective, and kind of the nuances of his relationship to his wife and son, those are interesting, and those could be carried to, you know, more complicated, it carried out in much more extended, complicated ways, right? And instead, you just kind of get this, almost these two out of nowhere violent climaxes that are shocking and certainly to some extent affecting, because, you know, Wagner's a good enough author to make that affecting. But that don't really feel like it doesn't, you know, like that kind of violence, that kind of explosion of violence is meaningful if we have been fearing it for a long time, or if we have the sense that something is coming and we don't quite know what it is, but it is just kind of nonsensical in a way, right? There's nothing in the narrative or the characters up to that point that would lead you to expect that. And I mean, the guy's got $150 million and loves his family. Like, he could weather this whole thing pretty well, really, you know, in the scheme of things. Like, he's not being presented with an intolerable challenge. And so, I don't know, it just feels kind of both exploitive and like it's short-circuiting, circumventing a more interesting narrative and a narrative that might actually have more to say. And then again, with GG, right? Like, I thought GG actually, like, he was a very interesting character and the setup is very interesting, right? Like, I really enjoyed that. And again, like, it's compressed into a third of a novel and then he just kind of like has Parkinson's and dies. And it, yeah, I don't know. That lack of narrative focus and that habit of kind of like, I don't know, like, I would have liked to see any of these three pieces turned into a well-crafted work the length of this book, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that, like, somebody who really likes this could maybe make an argument that there's something that's being done here that I'm ignoring and I'm you know, not valuing what it does actually do, but...
Sorry to, like, kind of jump onto your questions, but you also asked about... you wonder, in one of your questions, you wondered what all the references to Marvel were doing. Now, I'm not quite sure. Like, I definitely felt like the references to Marvel as a motif were mysterious. I wasn't quite sure what they were doing. I wasn't sure they were necessary. I do notice that, you know, the book's called Marvel Origin Stories, and the structure of the novel deals with characters in the same way that Marvel movies deal with characters, in that they, you know, they often, especially like the larger Marvel movies with tons of
ensemble.
Yeah, with ensemble casts and, right, and like tons of different characters. Like, you get this teeny bit of, you know, character backstory or character development, and then you move on to some other character. And is Wagner satirizing that about Marvel movies, or is he just doing it and, hey, it turns out to be as shitty in this book as it is in Marvel movies? I'm not sure.
I was wondering about the ensemble thing. It made me think, like, it feels like most stories about Hollywood or celebrity culture become ensemble stories. Like, there's something about, like, that. There's something about how we think about that slice of reality and how those people live their lives and how we portray that. It tends to be about parties and, oh, look, there's Guillermo del Toro and
Del Taco.
Actually, I'm... Del Taco, yeah. I'm Elon Musk's love child, and Hugh Jackman. My wife would love to know that I spoke with Hugh Jackman. Like, there's something about, like, that in that environment that almost, you know, when a story is about, like, real, or when a story is about celebrity culture, that feels like a pretty big gravity well to fall into, the ensemble sort of thing. And I kind of wondered whether, I don't know. I really have no idea what the Marvel thing is. I don't know if it's, it doesn't feel like, that does anything to me. And I actually enjoyed this novel, but, you know,
other than the ensemble similarity, what's it doing?
Well, I was saying, I think I really honestly feel like that's more like the movie Babylon, and, or I'm just sort of blanking on books about celebrity culture. I thought of a few of them and it just was like, oh yeah, that one was an ensemble sort of story too. Oh yeah. And oh yeah. Unless it is like about some you know, director or writer, or someone going on like a walkabout and they're in their own head and they're sort of like taking a break. It feels like most of the stories are about swimming in waters with many, many famous faces. And, but then I guess that that doesn't necessarily make it an ensemble story, because this is, you know, sort of like mostly people adjacent to that, sphere. So maybe I'm making that up, but I don't know. I didn't know what to do with the Marvel shit.
I think that your point, Patrick, about kind of you could read it as a critique of the truncated ensemble stories, or the way that the ensemble format truncates individual stories. But I don't know that that seems too kind almost in a way, right? Like that's giving too much credit to something that also kind of...
Right. No. Yeah. I agree.
To some extent, I guess, like, many of the characters' lives and psychologies are structured a little bit around the ubiquity of Marvel, right? Like, Portia's daughter, Trixana, she experiences life through the prism of Marvel because she has delusions, and that's what happens to... That's, like, the matrix that the delusions kind of seize onto. And Adele kind of understands, basically equates appearing in a Marvel movie with success. And so there's a way in which it kind of creates a framework that they all live in. But I don't know that it's really saying anything about that. It's just kind of an incidental structural, it's an incidental quirk of the structure, not really a feature per se. We've been talking a little bit about what was controversial about this novel, right? The fact that it was controversial. And just to kind of touch back on that a little bit, I think that my understanding, and this is, I could be wrong on the details of this, my understanding is that the points of controversy were less about the appearance of real people, more so about, first, the character of the Fat Joan, the term fat just being thrown around so casually, and then the implication in the third section that some people who came forward during the Me Too era were not entirely honest and virtuous, which seems like a much less... basically, like, I think, like, the culture has drifted enough in 5 years that, like, having a novel in which one there's a character who is slinging false rape accusations is more thinkable than it would have been 5 years ago, particularly given that the person, there's an irony there, right, where the person who's being accused is in fact a rapist who has ruined a life, just not the one he's being accused of, right? And I think our sensitivities have changed enough that that's tolerable as a possibility now in a way that it probably wouldn't have been in 2020, 2021. And I think actually to the novel's credit and to the credit of the people who've kind of, you know, salvaged it from cancellation, the stuff that was connected to that I mostly found pretty interesting and artistically defensible, right? I mean, like, the psychology of Joan's, the way that the psychology of Joan's weight gain is explained, the way that there's kind of like the way that it's framed as this reaction to a traumatic event in a kind of logical way. I don't know how, you know, I don't know if that's something that's based on particular people in real life, but it made intuitive sense to me, and I actually found it interesting and courageous, and I liked that bit, you know. And I think that the character of Gigi and the irony of kind of, you know, the experiencing this kind of fake accusation that plays into the guilt he has from real crimes, I think that's a really fascinating scenario. It wasn't explored a tenth as much as it could have been, but it was a creative setup, and I do think that probably the willingness to... It was a very creative setup that couldn't have existed without a certain willingness to write in a way that didn't feel obsessively virtue policed, you know? And so I don't know, that's cool. And that's literary, you know? But it kind of failed its own ideas to some extent.
Yeah. I mean, I found myself, caring about Joan, caring about Gigi, caring about Bud. There was one particular sort of section sort of tracing Bud's just really like intractable tight orbit around his addictions, and that was actually like kind of just amazing to me. I think that the kind of two things that we have, going back to the question is like whether, could you repeat the question, Hans? Sorry.
Oh, I didn't ask a question. The question that I had written to ask, I implied a question. The question that I had written in question form was basically whether the response of the publisher in refusing to publish it for essentially moral reasons was merited, right? If the novel is offensive or insensitive in ways that should in fact have been an impediment to its publication and should have caused reputational harm for its publishers and author.
No, I don't think so. This is my own sort of soapbox dislike for what is often called cancel culture. I think that that's also it's itself is a kind of a weapon in cancel culture, is to actually like cause something cancel culture. If that makes sense, there's kind of a recursive like snake eating its own tail quality to the whole discussion of like what we allow ourselves to talk about in culture. But just fundamentally, I think that it makes it hard to empathize with different people if we're not able to talk in certain ways or hear how they talk. And I think that it actually divides us more to be super precious about how we talk about things. The Fat Joan, Gigi's guilt and shame, I don't know if there's something, I don't know what I would point to in the second book that would like be so problematic. It really feels like books one and three. Those to me are the things that really felt alive, you know, like the language is really alive. Wagner is a great, just sort of like writer for the experience of reading. And I think that some of that comes with a little bit of the, you know, like the vivid irreverence that he takes into all of these subjects. And I really enjoyed that. And I think that he found the on-ramp to caring about characters that it's very hard to care about, despite the kind of cynical ways in which he really portrayed them and talked about them. And I think that's such a great magic trick. And what I was going to say before I remembered that I didn't really know what question I was trying to answer was that I feel like it's kind of tied to, I feel like there's the beginning of redemption for like for this writing style, for how he's choosing to write this book, but he doesn't really fulfill it. You know, I think that it ultimately is worth, I'm glad that this book exists. I enjoyed reading it. I don't think that it is purely insensitive, though, because there is that sort of like drilling down through these very like cold, derogatory ways of seeing these characters sometimes, and really, you know, potentially problematic treatment of really horrific things like rape. But you find yourself in places of empathy that I wish paid off more. And it feels like we get to that place and the novel could become something a little bit more than what it is. When Bud is basically going to, Bud has, I guess, carved a bunch of scratch tickets into his own body, and he's speaking to Joan, and Joan is, you know, suitably freaked out. And then Ollie kills him. It feels like that is actually like Bud as this incredible, like, fuck up, like this incredible, like, mess that Joan has basically kept at bay all her life. And he's now in her circle. They're potentially coming closer, and the confrontation, which has like lots of potential stake to it, is cut off by Allie, who's turned into a giant bird biting his, you know, through his jugular. Like, that's, there's something in how that interruption, like, breaks that narrative, that arc, that, like, feels like it's going to have dramatic, sort of like something really dramatically interesting could happen there, that almost makes me think like it could be, you know, you could say like, well, you're not really doing with this what you could be doing with this. So maybe there is a case there for saying, you know, like, if you're not actually going to spend the time to follow these characters through these dramatic moments and see how they, like, you know, grow or shrink or whatever, then, you know, it isn't actually, you haven't earned the right to be as irreverent as you're being, even if, like, despite that irreverence, you find, like, these really interesting characters. So there's a bit of a, like, a kind of a disappointment that I think comes with, like, well, you're being so brave, so why are you being such a pussy? You know, like,
it's brave and lazy.
It's brave and lazy. That's what it is. Yeah. And so, like, I guess, like, I really enjoyed the irreverence. I didn't feel like it was very bad. You know, you're making fun of a morbidly obese billionaire, like, who enjoys eating and is, you know, trying to get as fat as possible, and then starts, you know, losing weight because she's fallen in love with someone who has ALS, or maybe it's the, you know, like, the fact that she's attracted to young celebrity women, Billie Eilish, Millie Bobby Brown. I really couldn't come up with anything that is, that feels like it's that bad, I guess. So it's kind of maybe hard to answer that question.
I would like to say that, just to add to add my two cents on that question, if the publishers, you know, if their response was merited, and I just want to say they're cowards. They're pieces of shit cowards.
The publishers are cowards for...
Yeah, I mean, come on. This book is not any more offensive than a ton of other well-regarded novels. Hans, you compared this to No One Is Talking About This by Patricia Lockwood. I feel like there was offensive stuff in that. The only reason that
there
is
bravery
is
there is bravery in No One Is Talking About This. Like, that's an intensely brave novel.
Yeah,
sorry.
And it's better. It's significantly better than this novel. But the only reason the publisher rejected this is because of the fact that characters in the novel are represent real famous people. And like, that's the only reason I really don't think you can convince me otherwise. They were worried that one of these people wouldn't like how they were portrayed. And so they're like, oh God, no, we better not publish this because we're cowards and we only want money. We don't care about, you know, art or anything like that. We're just business people. We're profit people. So yeah, they're pieces of shit cowards. Just wanted to say that.
I didn't put this in the list of questions, and I feel like we've actually, I don't know if I've asked every single question I had, but I feel satisfied with the discussion of everything that I had in mind. But I probably would be remiss if I didn't bring up spirituality, right? Because I didn't really think about this, and I didn't read Bruce Wagner's biography until after I had finished this, the questions, but he is actually a person who's very interested in spirituality. He's studied with monks, and he's actually very, well, I'll see if I can read you the relevant passages here just for context, right? He was part of Carlos Castaneda's inner circle and was close to that group after Castaneda's death. After Wagner's novel Memorial was favorably reviewed by a Buddhist monk, Wagner wrote its editor a letter of thanks. Wagner and two partners own the television and film rights to Castaneda's book, and Wagner has studied with Indian guru Ramesh Balsekar. And there's a little bit of that, right? I remember I kind of singled out in my synopsis, I singled out the... There's a character in the second book who is it's an old man. And it's kind of funny because he, in the synopsis, he's referred to as a black man incarcerated unjustly for murder, which is like true, but also suggests a version of the character that you don't get, right? He was in fact a murderous pimp who just... He was a piece of shit who just happened to get a serial killer pinned on him as a way of, for PR's sake, right? But he's not blameless as an individual, but he has become a Buddhist monk and achieved peace and enlightenment. And his character is exceptionally peripheral, even in a novel where there are a lot of peripheral things, right? Like he just kind of randomly, he just dies of heart failure and then turns out to not be Trixana's father. And then that's it for him, even though he's, you know, presented on the back of the book as one of the key characters. He probably occupies about 30 pages of page space and affects nothing. So my question as I was reading it was, why is he here? And I wonder if there's some kind of spiritual idea that we're missing that he is meant to signal or emphasize.
Well, I'm not sure, and this goes back to the connection with Marvel, but I think the failure, the character is a failure, like his storyline doesn't add up to much, but he is a nice object for Trixana's delusions about herself as what's the character's name, Laura X or whatever from the Wolverine movie Logan. So there is there are plenty of parallels between the film Logan, which I've seen, and Trixana and the pimp guy dying in prison. So I think he's there to like to function as support for Trixana's storyline and to like fill out the parallelism between Wolverine and Trixana and whatnot. But ultimately I do think it doesn't work. But I think that's why it's there.
Well, I mean, Trixana's story is not that interesting either. I mean, like, it just
right,
it feels
it's
like
not, yeah.
Yeah, it feels like the story is Portia and Arnold, and
right. Yeah, yeah. That I agree.
Yeah, and so you know, it's so interesting to me that Wagner's, you know, at least has a history of being someone who's very interested in spirituality and seeking spirituality, because this is such a cynical book. I don't know what sort of, like, maybe Joan and Ali ascending, I think is the term that we're given. But I don't know what that means. And I think that in and of itself is actually like kind of a weak sort of ending to that first section of the novel. I don't know what to do with spirituality in this book.
All right. Well, that seems like a good place to wrap up our discussion of Bruce Wagner's The Marvel Universe Origin Stories. An interesting novel. I found myself propulsively compelled to read it, even as I was disappointed by it. Takes risks in admirable ways, and then also does not... not only doesn't stick the landing, but doesn't even end up in the right airport. Things that are very admirable and interesting, things that are really quite a letdown. So very mixed bag, but you know, it's available for free on the internet. So Patrick, I think you are up next. Yeah. What is our next pick?
I think we're gonna do Exile in the Kingdom, a collection of short stories by Camus. I think that's what I want to do.
Yeah.
All right. Very good.
The book has six short stories, four of which I remember being really good, ranging from like awesome to good, and two of which I remember maybe being duds. But the four that are really good are certainly worth discussing. I also wanted to send you several of the stories in at least three of them that I can remember take place in colonial Algeria before the Algerian War of Independence in 1962, I think is when it ended. I think it started in like 56 or 57 or 58 and then ended in 62, at 2 years after Camus had died in a car accident. But I also wanted to include a journalistic piece that Camus had written in his youth about conditions, poverty conditions in Algeria, just to kind of give us some context for like, you know, what colonialism was like. Like, at the very least, it would help you guys who are probably less familiar with colonialism in Algeria to like get a better idea of some of the specifics of colonial Algeria. So, and that I'm not sure that is available online or anything, so I will find a free PDF or photocopy from my book and send that article to you. So Exile in the Kingdom and the article that I'm going to send to you. It's probably still less than 200 pages, so it's not like, you know, huge or anything. Sound all right?
Okay.
Sure.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, cool.
All right. Well, thank you much for your time, gentlemen. Tune in to the next episode of Book Spider, wherein we'll be discussing Exile in the Kingdom by Albert Camus. And keep on spidering, everybody.
Yeah.
Hell yeah.
Spider away.
Agreed.
Thanks, guys.
Talk to you later.
Peace out.